Alright, hello, welcome to Daily-ish for Thursday, June 18th. It's something like 20 degrees outside. This isn't a weather podcast. This episode of Daily-ish is brought to you by my Patreon supporters, patreon.com/iChris. And if you want to sign up for some web hosting, visit a small orange. You can find the links at goodstuff.fm/dailyish/this is 105. And I've got a special episode today with a special guest of a certain amount of fame. He denies it, but I know if you run a popular website in 2015, you're rolling in money. So, I'm joined by Matt McGee. Welcome, Matt.
Hey, Chris. Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah. So, Matt, by way of introduction, runs at U2.com, a website that, as you might surmise, talks about U2. And I've been known to talk about U2 on this podcast. And a previous guest, friend of the show, as it were, Christopher Schmidt, thought I should chat with Matt. And I thought that would be a great idea, but he's an insanely popular webmaster.
Who is this guy? You have me confused with someone.
So anyways, Christopher made our introductions, and so now here we are chatting about U2. So welcome to the show. This is you've done the podcast thing before, right?
We used to have an at U2 podcast years ago, and it was so much work to do, and just the kind of thing, just coordinating it and then the producing of it and just gathering, just from chatting with you for the last 10 minutes, it seems like technology has really developed lately, and is it much easier now than it used to be?
It is, and it isn't. Like, at Good Stuff here, we've made it complicated probably with some of the stuff with live streaming and all that kind of stuff, but certainly it's easier probably. When was it that you, like, are we talking 5 years ago?
Or? No, I'm talking more than five. I'm talking probably 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And so I wasn't the producer of it. A gal named Teresa Cook was the primary producer of ours. And so we'd have guests, we'd have like three or four of us just kind of get on. I don't remember if we used Skype or GarageBand or something. I don't remember I just remember that it was just a very difficult thing to give birth to, every month. And we just got to the point where, like, look, there's not enough listeners to justify this incredible effort that we're putting into this. So yeah, we stopped doing it. But if it's much easier now, if the technology is better, then maybe, I don't know.
Yeah, it seems actually, that was where our mutual acquaintances were arranged too, is Christopher Schmidt and I used to help out with U2log.com, another U2 mm-hmm. blog of sorts. And that's where I met Christopher. And we had a very short, probably shorter lived than yours. I think it was 6 or 7 episode podcast that we did back in the day. And I think it was I don't know why this is significant to me, but the tour where the Edge. Well, and I can only say this to you and know that you'll understand. Right. The tour where the Edge was fighting for his Malibu land, like building house that he was trying to build or something.
Right.
I forget what tour that was.
I think that began like 6-8 years or so ago, didn't it? Or maybe 10 years ago.
Only there was a website we could look things up on. But no, yeah. Yeah, anyway, so we started it then and it lasted about 6 or 7 episodes because the thing, I don't know if this is what you guys seem to have, you have tons of volunteers, staff or whatever on the site, so you can get out to the shows and stuff and get people, obviously, and readers of your site submit tour news and stuff also, but it's tough to maintain a tour podcast about you too if nobody from the podcast is actually ever attending a show, so.
That does make it difficult, yeah.
Yeah. So you've been running, I looked actually, it's been 20 years now, at U2 started in 1995, right?
Yeah, October 23rd, 1995, it went online. That's it wasn't just a U2 site on day one. It was, I think it was called Matt's Mostly U2 Music Page. And so I had you'd find like a new photo from what would have been then? It would have been like the Hold Me, Thrill Me, Kiss Me, Kill Me, like a photo from the Batman. And so you'd put the, wow, I found a new photo online. Incredible. Let's put it on your website. Right? Like, that was like huge news back then if you found a new photo.
Yeah.
And so, but I had some stuff from like REM and Toad the Wet Sprocket. And then, that lasted for a couple months and it just eventually quickly became about nothing but U2.
Yeah. The kids these days have no idea how hard it was to actually be a fan digitally of a band.
Right? I have a 17-year-old son, and on the last tour on 360, we would sit, and I don't know if you remember this or if you watch too, but like fans over in Europe, like I don't remember which show it was, like Switzerland or Poland or something like that, and some guy was using some video streaming thing that I'd never even heard of, but he was like video streaming the concert from his seats in the stadium. And here we are sitting, you know, 1 o'clock in the afternoon in Washington State, USA, watching this live concert online. And like my jaw's on the ground and my son's just like, yeah, you know, no big deal. And I'm like, you have no idea. This is really incredible.
Exactly. Yeah, I know. Now with like Periscope and stuff, anybody could just, you know, fires up their phone and live streaming concert. Here you go. Well, that's what U2 is using Meerkat. Apparently on this tour, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
Which is, that's interesting that they've sort of chosen that one. I don't know. I have no inside baseball or any knowledge of why or what happened as to why they chose that one.
I didn't either, but apparently Sherry Lawrence from our staff had read an article saying that Guy Ossiri, the new manager, and Universal Music have invested in Meerkat.
Ah.
So I bet the money is the reason that they use that instead of Periscope.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting how it all comes about.
Yeah, so that's where their allegiance is right now. So yeah, it's cool that they're using it though. I mean, it's a nice, you know, a nice step in that sort of current modern, you know, sort of direction for them. So I like that.
Yeah, and U2 has notoriously sort of been, well, I don't know, maybe it's not that notorious outside of U2. If you're not a U2 fan, you probably could care less, but they've sort of been standoffish in terms of the whole social stuff and internet stuff, even like, well, U2 Log was kind of started as a, oh, wow, U2 has a webcam. Let's catalog the video, I think, or the screenshot, not
sure. Oh, right. Yeah.
Photos from it, I think, is what Caroline over at U2 Log, when she started, it was kind of just like, they put up a webcam. Let's take screenshots of that and archive those somewhere.
Yeah, those were good times.
Which, again, just sounds so nuts to anybody these days where bands are, you know, taking photos, Instagram videos, whatever, all the time. But U2 has been very withdrawn or guarded in any of that kind of thing.
Right. Like even on the last tour when The Edge had a Twitter account, he refused to type any text, right? He just published photos because he was afraid that, you know, if he actually said something that it would get twisted and taken out of context. And so it was all just very, you know, very cautious and hesitant with just posting photos as sort of like a traveling journal of sorts, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, which, again, it just feels like I don't even care necessarily as a fan. It's kind of it's funny to have this dichotomy of, like, this band that you look up to and, you know, think is rock and roll stuff and dangerous or whatever. Not that U2 has ever really been that dangerous, but you have that vision. But then you also, now they're like, for me anyways, like my dad's age almost, and fearful of technology and, you know, struggling to check their email or something.
Right, exactly.
It's kind of like, how do you balance these two things in my head? But
it's funny, like you'll see, like I'll read, like there'll be an article in like Rolling Stone or Billboard or whatever, you know, some newspaper, and it'll say, you know, we got this statement via email from Bono, right? And I'm immediately thinking, like, what would it be like to trade emails with Bono? Like, does he forget to type the subject line?
Yeah.
You know, does he like reply all when he only means to send a, you know, one person reply? Yeah. Like, totally. Like, I'd love to know what that's like.
Yeah, just in celebrity in general, you wonder, like, if you're on some list and you're like, oh shoot, now Bono's going off again about whatever, you know, some charity or something or something. Like,
right.
Get me off this mailing list that Bono's
exactly on. Block, mute.
Yeah. Totally. So with this tour now, the one that's Experience and Innocence and Experience, sorry, I got Elevation mixed in there somehow. But what have you guys sort of aim to do different, or like, has this tour kind of helped you with, again, with all the technology and stuff that's going around and people you have all over the place? What has been sort of your attempts or focus or changes in terms of how you're reporting on this tour?
I think what we're trying to do, I think, you know, video, you know, both live and recorded video is just kind of where it's at, you know, at the moment. And we, I think we probably, you know, for years, you know, going back to the Elevation tour, you know, and then Vertigo as well, we were more focused on still photos. Like, you know, I'd ask all of our crew, you know, if you're at the show, you know, take as many great pictures as you can. Let's get them on Flickr and let's, you know, share them and spread them around and all this sort of stuff. And of course, this was, you know, pre-Twitter and pre-Facebook and all that. And so we were kind of slow, I think, to just to, you know, to dive into the video thing. And, you know, now that, you know, everybody's smartphone is a video camera, and, you know, now that, you know, digital cameras, you know, they are, you know, they get smaller and have, you know, more video capabilities. You know, we just decided, I think, you know, on the last tour on 360, as, you know, we started figuring out, you know, it's just as easy and you know, more engaging for fans around the world to actually just be able to watch the video instead of seeing a still photo, you know, get the whole, you know, 4 minute, 5 minute performance, or whatever it is. So, I mean, I think that's kind of been our focus. And we've done a little bit with the Periscope thing, like during the shows. I did, what was it, the second concert in Phoenix, I was there, and just decided to Periscope the second half of the show. And Chris, I got to tell you, I hated it. I mean, it was nice because, you know, I know we got a lot of great feedback, like thanks for the Periscope feed, and it looked great, and it sounded great. And you know, that was fantastic. But just for me, like being the person in the arena doing the Periscoping, I was like, you know, my arms are, you know, tired, and I'm so appreciative of the fans now that do this, like for each show. But I'm like, how are you able to enjoy the show when you're actually doing this? Because I don't know. I felt like so much pressure to make sure I was, you know, getting the right shot and you know, everything looked good and sounded good. So I don't know. Just personally, I didn't enjoy doing it, but I love that other fans are willing to do it. And it's it's an incredible to think about how the tour experience has changed over the last, you know, just 10 or 15 years.
Yeah. And is there no, I was debating this with Christopher Schmidt the other day, just in our Slack chat, but there's no like legal issues that you're up against with posting? Cause you're like the videos you're talking about are on your YouTube page, YouTube channel, which I'll link to. And it's incredible and it's great. Like it's awesome quality. It's posted within days of the concert almost. And
sometimes hours.
Yeah. And so,
yeah, I mean, so like, you know, They do, you know, if they, some of the shows we were at earlier in the tour, they did, you know, like the first time they did Bad, was that Vancouver, the second Vancouver show. Like we rushed back to the hotel room. We're like, we got to get this video online right now, you know, just like
totally.
I mean, it's with it. Are there legal? I don't know. I mean, they've never done. I mean, if you go back, like even to, you know, like YouTube was founded in what, 2004, I guess. So on the Vertigo tour, you know, people started posting some videos, and like, I've never been aware of any effort from, you know, the band or the record labels that have been involved over the years. I've just never seen any effort from them to say, you know, no, take this concert video off. And I think part of that may be because YouTube developed a program where the creators can make money from that, where they can allow advertising to be shown on these. So, you know, if we post, you know, a video of Bad, and then YouTube's going to show some ads on that video page, and then any, you know, any money that ad generates gets shared with both YouTube and with U2. So I think that probably has something to do with it, but I don't know. Maybe it's just that they're recognizing that it's, you know, it's something fans want to do, and it, you know, hopefully, I mean, I'd like to think that they recognize that it's good advertising for them, that, you know, if we're posting videos and then other fans, you know, see the videos, oh, wow, I got to go see that screen in person, or I want to go, you know, this tour looks fantastic, and et cetera, et cetera. So,
yeah. And that's where, like, it sort of seems at odds with the U2 of old, Zoo TV era, anyways, whatever. I remember reading in Bill Carter's book or one of the YouTube books, anyways, where, you know, Bono meticulously going over every video shot that they're going to release in this, you know, VHS video right at the time of the concerts, and sort of like not wanting to release anything that wasn't, whatever, jokingly about maybe him being tall or short or whatever, right? Like showing right and stuff like
exactly
that. But so then to have this kind of stuff out there where the concert is being shown, and I guess the conceit is everybody knows it's, you know, it's an iPhone and it's shaky. It's not going to be amazing sound quality, but you get a picture of it. Because I know for me watching like before the tour started, and I saw pictures of the stage and, you know, the sort of rumors and stuff that were dripping out and press releases and things, I wasn't super excited because I felt like, well, it's just going to be new songs in the old tour. But then, yeah, seeing some of the videos and stuff that's come out, and I'm sort of geographically located in a weird spot that's hard to get to. It's sort of middle of Canada, so I have to go far east, far west, and just isn't working right now. But now I'm actually sort of disappointed that I didn't make the effort to get out to one of the shows, and hoping they're going to come back again on a arena tour or whatever, a concert or a stadium tour or something after Europe. But I hope that U2 sees the value of it, and they seem to be. Obviously, they could choose to be jerks or lawyer up and get you guys to take them all down or whatever, but that's good to hear.
Be awfully hard to do just because there's, I mean, it's so prevalent right now with everybody having, you know, smartphones or bringing it. And by the way, you know, the official policy for the tour is that, you know, obviously they can't, you know, you're going to bring a smartphone in. They can't not let you do that. But just like they've done for the past several tours, it's fine to bring in, you know, a small digital camera too, a point and shoot. The official policy is you can't bring in a camera that has detachable lenses, and you can't bring in a dedicated video camera. But anything else is fair game. So, I mean, I think they're, and that's, they started doing that back on the Elevation Tour. That was the first time where they said, all right, we're going to let you bring small cameras in. And so they've been, they've been really good about that. And I think, you know, they recognize, you know, that it'd probably be a big game of whack-a-mole if they tried to, to start taking these videos offline. So
yeah, exactly. So how many shows, which shows have you seen on this tour already?
I saw the first two in Vancouver, then skipped San Jose and saw the two in Phoenix. So I've seen four so far.
And plans to go to more?
Plans to go to more. If I could, I would drop everything and go to every show. Which I've never felt like on any past tour. Like, really? I've always enjoyed the tours and, you know, love the shows I've been to generally. But it's like, you know, Vancouver was so off the charts good. I was like, holy smokes, I need to go see every show. I told my wife, I said, if I didn't have a job, if your real estate career was like so incredible that I didn't have to work, I'd be like, see you in August. I mean, it's, the shows are really, really incredible. And so I'm tempted to, like, I'm looking at this calendar, like, you know, like even this morning, I'm like, well, what's airfare to this city and what's airfare to that city and you know, what would a hotel cost? So I mean, I'm definitely we're having a big 20th anniversary party in late July, right before the last two shows in New York. So I'll be going to those shows, and if there's any, you know, financial way to squeeze in more between now and then, I'm ready to do it. It's really, really good.
So this is something, I guess, that I completely appreciate and understand, but I know, I'm thinking back to, I went to Montreal on the Vertigo tour, I think it was, and I went to Edmonton on the Pop Mart tour, and both times they had two concerts in the cities, night after night or whatever, and I went to both. But normal friends of mine who aren't, bigger U2 fans couldn't really understand why I would go to two shows, let alone many shows.
Right, exactly.
And so what is it, do you think, that draws you into wanting to go to more? Obviously it's not like going to a movie, which is the exact same script, exact same scenes all night after night, but people do that as well. So what is it about going to see a band, and in particular obviously U2, night after night and many times over, that is keeps you coming back?
Well, I think for me, and I think probably for a lot of people, you know, there's just a certain, I mean, there's a certain feeling, right? It's like Streets is my favorite song. I'm actually not a big fan of the way they're doing it this tour. It doesn't have the same kind of oomph for me. But there's just a feeling of being in that building and them playing, you know, for 2.5 hours. And I don't know. Like, I love, I mean, at some point, I guess we have to talk about the set lists and all that sort of stuff. And I know a lot of fans, you know, complain that, you know, the set list doesn't change enough, and they want, you know, all these, you know, rare songs and different songs, and why is the first half of the show the same practically every night and all sorts of. I love the fact that a U2 show has a bit of Broadway in it. I mean, that there's an actual story that they're telling, and I find the story that they're telling in that first half of the show about, you know, the 70s, you know, in the band's early days. I mean, it starts with Iris, which is about Bono's mom. Then it expands a little, and the next song is Cedarwood Road, which is about not, you know, so his mom, you know, that's sort of like what was going on in my house. And then the next song is Cedarwood Road, which is sort of like, here's what was going on with my street and my friends. And then it gets into Song for Someone, which is about, so they've gone from house to street, and now Song for Someone is sort of about girls and Allie and school. And so it's like this sort of flower opening up on, you know, Bono's sort of childhood, in particular his teen years. And then from that, then it gets into Raised by Wolves, which is, you know, about, you know, the 1974 incident that happened in Dublin. I just find it fascinating the way that they've sort of, you know, this progression of these songs and the story that it tells. And then it gets into Sunday Bloody Sunday and Until the End of the World. That it's such a compelling thing to me that I could just watch that, you know, time and time again. I would go, like I said, I would go every night and for that. And then, you know, I think they are making an effort to, you know, to change things up, you know, to some degree at least. You know, obviously they could always do more. But, you know, look, they're the artists, and as long as they are playing what they want to play, you know, it's not the same exact show every night. I saw there was a tweet, one of the Rolling Stone writers sent a tweet out like a month ago, and I think it said Bob Dylan changed his set list for the first time in like 28 years or something like that, or 18 years. And I just looked at it, I'm like, wow, could you imagine? Like, do Bob Dylan fans, are they as angry about this as U2 fans would be?
Right? Yeah, exactly.
So
if they went all acoustic or something and didn't.
Right. So I don't know. I find it a really I love the fact that they don't just come out. I mean, I've seen concerts, and I'm sure you have too, Chris. I've seen concerts where the band, they just come out and they play one song, then they play another song, then they play another song. And I mean, it's good. And I've seen REM tours, and that's the way REM did it every time they've seen them. There's no sort of story going on. There's no sort of narrative. And I love the fact that you two has that narrative, and I just find it really compelling.
Yeah, which I think is again something where if you just look at the set list, you might catch what you're, you know, the stuff that you're talking about, but until you either listen through the show, and I'm listening to the Christopher Schmidt had told me to check out Vancouver's Night 2, the audio from that, and or the video I think is on at U2's page probably too, but listen to that, and until you listen to it all the way through, and for me that's always where U2 songs come alive, is either if I happen to get to the concert or seeing the concert video or whatever documentary or whatever video afterwards, because then the songs actually, you know, you see how they breathe next to everything else, and
totally, yeah. Yep.
So in lieu of that, I guess, like you said, with the set list and stuff, how has this tour sort of felt, been different for you from previous tours in terms of, because it feels like, you know, they don't have a there's definitely a dramatic element to it, a theme to it, but in terms of presentation style and stuff, it doesn't have the sort of big thing that people, you know, the iconic thing that people looked for in the past of, you know, like a Pop Mart tour or the Zoo TV tour. It feels like, and maybe that's where people are seeing this sort of as a bit of a vanilla run from even 360 to,
yeah, it's, you know, funny that you're right. That's a really good point, because, you know, you could look at a photo of the Zoo TV tour and say, holy Moses, what am I looking at? Right.
Yeah.
And the same thing with the Pop Mart stage, and the same thing with 360, as you were saying. I mean, so I guess just from the photos, I mean, you're right. I hadn't even thought about that it does kind of look just kind of like a regular arena show, but really, when you get into that, I mean, that video screen it's so off the charts crazy that like at the very first Vancouver show, you know, the first four songs, like at every show, the first four songs, the everything's turned off. It's just the band on stage with some lights. It's like a little club show, right? And then the video screen comes on for Iris, and you know, so there's some video up there, and it's cool. And then at Cedarwood Road, you're watching Bono, and all of a sudden, wait a second, are there stairs? Is he like actually climbing up to the video screen? And he is. And then you're like, all right, where did he go? Is he on the other side of the video screen? And then all of a sudden, the song starts, and he's in the dang thing, right? He's like in this video screen, and I'm like, I was shooting video that we, you know, that we put on YouTube. I'm shooting video, and like my jaw hits the ground when you're watching him in the video screen with he's like interacting with what's on the screen, and he's inside it. And like, I don't know, like when I see something that kind of blows my mind, I just start to like giggle uncontrollably like a little girl. Right. And so like, I spend this entire song, I'm just giggling the whole time. And so, like, oh my gosh, what am I saying? And so like then the next night, like Vancouver 2 and then the both Phoenix shows, I was down on the floor in GA. And what I love to do, I just love to turn around and look at the fans in the expensive seats, the you know, the 100 level seats. And just, I love to look at the looks on their faces when he shows up inside the screen, and they're like, everybody's just like, oh my gosh, what is this? And so It's. I mean, that to me is the sort of the iconic thing. I mean, this video screen is really innovative, and the way they're using it is really innovative. It's just your what you said is right. You don't get that impression unless you're actually in the room, or maybe if you're watching one of the videos of it. But just to see it in photos, you're like, oh, no big deal. It's just a video screen.
Yeah, and there's been a few, I know, on Instagram, you guys and others are, you know, obviously retweeting or regramming, I guess they're called on there. But, you know, people's photos from there. And there's a few angles, especially, and it seems like there's always somebody from one show that gets the angle of, I don't know what's actually happening. I forget, I don't know what song it's through, but Bono sort of looking up at himself, his big, huge head or something,
right,
on the screen, right? And it's like, holy crap, that's actually a really massive screen when you see it at scale like that, and what's actually going on visually and artistically or whatever with it. It's pretty incredible. And
yeah, they I mean, they use it so creatively, and during Until the End of the World, which may be what right, you're referring to. They have Bono's out on the E stage, and Edge is Edge the one in the screen at that point? Yeah, he is. Edge is the one walking in the screen at that point. And so they have this close up of Bono, and it's like, I don't know. I mean, I'd love to know how they do this every show. They get it so perfect. Like, it looks like Edge is like literally walking on Bono's hand because they have the camera so tight on Bono, and it's, you know, and it's right when he sings the line, "I reached out to the one I tried to destroy," which, you know, is so, you know, Bono's being Judas and Edge is being Jesus, which goes back to, you know, the same routine that they've done for that song all the way back to the Elevation tour. Anyway, it's just, it's such a clever, the screen is really so unique, and the way they use it is so clever, and it's just, I don't think you appreciate it until you're actually in that building.
Yeah, no, definitely. I can definitely, I know from the 360 tour, the last couple of tours anyways too, it was the same thing where until you were actually in the stadium or in the concert, it was hard to appreciate what was actually going on and how it was all connected and visually audio, which audio wise, much has been made sort of from what I've read anyways, is how the audio is much improved in this tour and how they have speakers sort of throughout the stadium or something. And to audio or concert audio novice like myself, I play guitar and stuff, so I'm aware of how some of this works, but it seems odd that in 2015, that's a breakthrough. You know, that,
right. Like, why didn't anybody think of this before, right?
Yeah. And so how did you find that, I guess? And is it hard? Can you tell it's better? Is it sort of just, or is it a nice press release, or how does it feel?
No, I think you can. It's, I think, you know, I, like in Vancouver, I remember it seemed a little bit on the loud side for, you know, at least for a couple songs. But it is noticeably better to me. And I think even if you're not there experiencing it, listen to some of the, you know, the audio quality on the videos that people post on YouTube, or listen, like last night, I was listening to last night's show. There was a gal that was using, this app called MixLR, and it's like this live audio app. And I swear so I'm just listening to it right over my computer. And I have a little Mac Mini. It's not like I have any phenomenal audio set up here. But I'll tell you, the audio quality that I was hearing last night was better than the bootlegs, you know, that you used to get, you know, 10, 15 years ago on tour. It was insanely good audio quality. I think it is. There's no echo, right? When you're in the show, there's absolutely no echo. You don't hear. It's not like I remember on past tours, like you would see Bono say something and then like there's this little split second delay for you actually hear what he said. It's just, it's all very immediate. I think the audio is a lot better. And, but I agree with you like 100%. Like, why weren't we doing this all along? Yeah.
It just seems odd because it's, and I'm sure there's like, you know, expensive probably to like haul speakers around or whatever. It just seems odd that a stadium wouldn't have that, but I guess maybe they bring their own speakers along or whatever. But I know in past it's like speakers are on the stage and they blast it out to the stadium, and I know in a few tours back they made the idea of putting a few speakers at the back sort of to like balance it out, and it was in sync somehow or whatever, and right. You didn't get as much echo, but yeah, then again in 2015 this would be innovation.
Yeah, everybody should be doing it there. I mean, and for those that don't know, they're hanging speakers from the ceiling, basically. I mean, there's all the rigging and trusses and all this sort of stuff on the top that, you know, typically hold lighting is now holding, you know, audio. And you know, you go into the show and you're standing down the floor, you can just look up and you can see, all right, there's a speaker, you know, right above the stage. There's another speaker, you know, 20 yards later, another big speaker 20 yards after that. And so it's, you know, just the whole ceiling of the arena has, you know, speakers covering it, and they're, you know, so they're pushing the sound down instead of pushing it from side to side.
Yeah. It's probably a few less blown eardrums and stuff through from those of you who are going night after night.
Yeah, exactly. And like I find that I haven't needed to use earplugs at all on this tour.
Right.
For any of the shows. Like I said, it was a little bit loud in Vancouver, but Phoenix, it sounded fantastic.
So is there still a song that you're holding out hope that they play either on this tour or that they've never played that you're like a deep catalog cut that you're
gosh no you know You know, it's funny. I'm not in the like Acrobat is the what the big song that everybody wants to hear, but I'm not. I'm not in that camp. Like, so no, there's not there. I mean, they're playing everything pretty much. I mean, like, I would love to hear, you know, One Tree Hill more regularly, you know, which I think a lot of fans would as well. I would love to hear Bad more consistently, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, I think what they're playing is really, I mean, it's, I think the set list is really good. I like the tweaks that they're making. Is there one? I don't know. I mean, I'd love to hear Drowning Man, but I'm afraid it might be really boring because it's such a slow song, right. And it's so. Take my hand. You know I'll be there if you can across the sky for your love. You know, so I don't know. I mean, there's songs I'd love to hear, but
yeah. The one going back to the set list thing, the comments that I've sort of thought about and read a bit of is like No Line on the Horizon is obviously fairly absent from most shows, and I don't know if I'm trying to remember if that's somewhat intentional where they try and sort of distance themselves from the previous album, but I know, you know, in the past they definitely have had more than. I think I can't remember, maybe one or two songs from the album have been played this tour, but it's definitely kind of been a bit of that swept under the rug feeling.
Yeah, I think, you know, I'll say two things on that. Number one, Bono says at pretty much every show that the theme of the show is surrender, right? So he keeps talking about, you know, surrender, whatever, you know, troubles in your life, you know, let it go, whatever's bothering you, whatever anger you have, you know, let it go, surrender. And so, you know, he says that word and he talks about that, you know, throughout the show. And he's done snippets of Moment of Surrender a few times. I would be shocked if we don't hear that full song at some point on this tour. My guess is that it may wait until Europe because I think the album probably was a little more European in sound and vibe and that sort of thing. And it obviously wasn't as well received here in the U.S. and Canada. So I think that will happen. But also I think, you know, probably, you know, since the idea of the show is innocence and experience, I think maybe it's just that. You know, like, where does a song like Magnificent fit into that? I mean, I don't think it does. You know, where does Breathe fit into that? I think probably it's just that those songs and that album was such a, you know, thematically, it just doesn't fit, you know, where they, you know, what they envisioned the story of this show to be.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good point. And it's, yeah, it may not be just something related to like what people want to make it about album sales or critical reception of an album,
right,
or whatever.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, U2, like we said earlier, definitely seems to be fairly intentional with why and what they choose to include. And it's not by accident that a song is generally put in.
Yeah, I agree 100%.
Unless fans are shouting really loudly from the front of the stage or whatever.
Or holding up signs or whatever.
Yeah. Which it is funny with this tour. And then there was moments in previous tours too. But I know, like, just the other night, Montreal night, what was it, night three or four, when like all of a sudden everybody was on, like a bunch of fans got invited up on stage to,
right,
during I still haven't found
Street.
What
I looked for. Yeah, Streets. They, yeah, he brought them up at the, like the end of this, the second half of Streets, and then they stayed on stage for Still Haven't Found.
Yeah, and so like in with the Meerkat thing and other stuff they've done where they have a fan come up and actually video the band during that portion or whatever, and it's a staged element that feels spontaneous, you know, or night after night, especially if you don't go every night to a show. Mm-hmm. But there definitely seems to be, and it'll be interesting to see with like the fans that knew that happened in Montreal, are they going to be sort of hoping for expecting, you know, in the future shows now to have get their invite up on stage to run around and do it.
That's right. I was wondering, you know, for Montreal, for last night's show in Montreal, the fourth one, like, you know, are they, can you even try to top something like that when you've brought 40 fans on stage? Like, there's really nothing you can do.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I mean, I think that's probably one of the drawbacks of, you know, those of us that are online constantly and watching this stuff like a hawk, you know, and we know everything that happens, and you know, so then it becomes easier to be let down by the next show. Oh, well, they did this the night before, and you know, they didn't do it again or whatever. And so, you know, but you think for the average fan that has no idea and doesn't pay attention to this stuff as closely as we do, it's, you know, it's just, it's a night and day experience. So
yeah, exactly. Cool. Well, that was that's a bunch of the stuff that I wanted to chat about with the tour. And you guys have been doing awesome work at U2.com.
Well, thank you, man. I appreciate it.
This tour especially, but just in general, obviously, in U2 fandom, as it were. And where can folks, obviously, the website at U2.com, any other places to recommend folks check out following along?
We do a lot of stuff on Twitter. You know, Twitter is a lot easier, you know, for covering, you know, for tweeting about shows and all that sort of stuff. So it's, you know, twitter.com/ATU and the number 2. That's probably the best way these days.
Cool. All right. Well, thanks, Matt, for coming on. And
thanks for having me, Chris. What a good time. And if we get a chance to do it again, I'd love to do it.
Yeah, for sure. And for you folks who are out there listening, if you're listening live, thanks for tuning in. Goodstuff.fm is where you can find this show. Obviously, you're there, but other shows as well. And Dailyish is my personal journal. This isn't actually normally an interview show, but sort of intersperse ramblings from my brain with other smarter folks with more interesting things to talk about. And but there's lots of other shows, all the great shows on Good Stuff. You can check out goodstuff.fm. So thanks for listening. Bye.